Welcome back to the History for Atheists podcast. I'm Tim O'Neill, and I'm the author of the History for Atheists blog, where I analyse some of the things many of my fellow atheists get wrong about history in general, and the history of religion in particular. If you're an atheist, or just someone interested in common misconceptions and myths about history, this podcast is for you. Hello and welcome back to History for Atheists. My guest today is Dr. Kip Davis. Kip is a biblical scholar and an expert in early Jewish literature and history with a focus on the Dead Sea Scrolls. He earned his PhD from the University of Manchester in 2009, has held several professional academic appointments in Europe and North America, and has published widely on the topics related to the Bible, its creation, development, and transmission in the Second Temple period. His work on manuscript forgeries in private collections and best practices for provenance research and conservation has been widely publicised in academic venues as well as in mainstream media. He presently works as a public-facing scholar and runs a YouTube channel where he regularly features videos and lectures promoting quality scholarship of the Bible. Today I'll be talking to Kip about Jewish apocalyptic thought, apocalyptic writings, and the relevance of these to an understanding of the historical Jesus. So, Dr. Kip Davis, it is a great pleasure to welcome you to History for Atheists. And we were just saying, it's the first time we've actually spoken.
In person, yeah. We've done lots of chatting back and forth on Twitter.
Yeah.
I refuse to call it the other thing. But But no, it's awesome to finally actually meet you in person. Have a chance to chat.
Well, I'm really happy to have you on because, you know, as you know, I have great interest in Jewish apocalypticism from the point of view of the origins of Christianity and looking at Jesus as, which I think he was, as an apocalyptic prophet. So that's really what I want to discuss with you today. The background to Jesus as an apocalypticist. But maybe before we get into that, you can give us a bit of a rundown on why I should have you on the show to talk about this and maybe a bit on your background.
And not so much. Okay. So, well, I am a scholar of early Jewish history and literature. Second Temple Judaism, which most of, I would say that most of our surviving texts, written material, is touched or influenced in one way or another by apocalypticism. So, like, this is the entire Second Temple Jewish world is saturated by this. So, I did my PhD working on the Dead Sea Scrolls, specifically working on a text or a group of manuscripts that have been called the Apocryphon of Jeremiah, which is a pretty fiercely apocalyptic text. So I've written some articles about apocalypticism in early Judaism, as well as in the modern world. One of my favorite articles that I ever wrote that I often refer people to is called "Zombies at Qumran." Sorry, "Zombies in America and at Qumran: The Walking Dead and the Dead Sea Scrolls in Apocalyptic Redux." And in that article, I actually explore the theme of apocalypticism within, you know, a modern American context and compare and contrast that with what we see in the scrolls. And it's a pretty eye-opening, fascinating sort of exercise when you take a look at, you know, modern expressions of this and compare this to, you know, where it began. And one of the striking things is how much an apocalyptic worldview has just never really shifted very much in terms of how it expresses itself. So, you know, I've also written a couple of articles comparing and contrasting early Jewish texts in terms of their expression, their expressions of apocalypticism, and you know, some of the origins of this these apocalyptic ideas. So
for those who might not be as familiar, how would you sort of define apocalypticism, and maybe we can talk a bit about the origins of Jewish apocalypticism?
Yeah, sure. And I'm glad you asked that question, because this is one of the things I think, I don't know if you meant to take me off there or you go, okay, I'll start over. So I'm glad you asked that question, because one of the things that I find when broaching this subject is people don't have a really good understanding of what apocalypticism is. Most people just think of apocalypticism as a, you know, a belief in the end of the world, or even a sense that the end of the world is imminent. When in actual fact, apocalypticism is a pretty developed sort of a worldview. My favorite definition, I actually have it on hand here, because I was preparing to talk about this. I think my favorite definition comes from a scholar of early Judaism by the name of Lorenzo Di Tommaso. And he said this. He said, apocalypticism asserts that a transcendent reality, concealed from casual observation yet operative on a grand scale, defines and informs existence beyond human understanding and the normal pale of world experience. It reveals a cosmos that is structured by two forces, good and evil, which have been in conflict since the dawn of history. It discloses a necessity and imminence of the final resolution of the conflict at the end of time, and the truth about human destiny. So, like, there's a few things in there that I think are really important to point out. The first one of these is this sense that the entire cosmos, our grand view of the universe and everything is it's laid out in this in a linear fashion from start to end, with like defined starting and ending points, and we're in there, and that overseeing all of this is a great god or a deity who controls everything. He can see the end from the beginning and the beginning from the end, and he's planned it all out. And within this view is this very sharp dichotomy between forces of good and forces of evil, which are all under the control of God, and which are in conflict, constant conflict with each other. And over the course of time, from the beginning of time through to the end, the forces of evil have been progressively increasing in power and strength, and are, you know, coming to the point near the end where they're overtaking the forces of good. And then at the end of time, God's going to break in and just, you know, set all the balances straight, destroy evil, and set up a kingdom of eternal goodness, I guess. Yeah. God's rule over humanity. So, you know, it's really, when I talk about apocalypticism, I prefer to talk about it as less focused on the end than it is really on the entire unfolding of time. Yeah. I think some of our earliest Jewish historical writing is apocalyptic. Like, it's an expression of history with a view to the end. It's a purpose filled perspective of all of time, and for that reason, it's also very important to know and understand history, where, you know, everyone came from, and the important, you know, milestones along the way, which were signals of this grand design of God, which was leading up to the final culmination in the end times.
So what would you say, how would you summarize the origins of this set of ideas? Because that's quite a different view of the cosmos to the one that we find in a lot of the Jewish scripture.
Yeah, so this is, and it's really, like, this is complicated and it's really in-depth. So yeah. there's a number of forces on the development of Jewish apocalypticism. Probably the strongest of those is already this existent perspective of prophecy within like Iron Age Israel, what I like to call the two kingdom period, from about 900 BCE to 586 BCE. There was two, and then there was a single kingdom of Israel, worshippers of Yahweh. And over this period of time, they had a strong sense of prophecy, which is not all that uncommon from the rest of the ancient Near East, from the rest of the land of Canaan, where these kingdoms were located. And, you know, court prophets, primarily temple prophets, out of which this institution emerged, were employed by the king in order to, as basically advisors. They were sort of the conduit between the king and the gods. The king would ask questions of the prophet. The prophet would consult the gods and advise the king on what he's supposed to do, right? So I think these are sort of the strongest roots of this. And in fact, you know, it's quite interesting. We have a good example, I think, of sort of this prophetic ideology outside of the Bible within the land of Israel, from the 8th century BCE. If I could just read a little bit from a text here. So this is I'll read this text and then I'll tell you what this is. So here, this is the prophet speaking, and he's speaking to his audience, and he says, "Be seated, and I will relate to you what the Shaddai gods have planned. And go see the acts of the gods. The gods have banded together. The Shaddai gods have established a council, and they have said to Shagar," this is a goddess, "sew up, close up the heavens with dense cloud, that darkness exists there, not brilliance, obscurity and not clarity, so that you instill dread in dense darkness, and never utter a sound again. It shall be that the swift and crane will shriek insult to the eagle, and a nest of vultures shall cry out in response. The stork, the young of the falcon and the owl, the chicks and the heron, sparrow and clusters of eagles, pigeons and birds and fowl of the sky, and a rod shall flay the cattle. Skilled diviner, where are the ewes? A staff shall be brought. Harries eat together, freely feed, O beasts of the field, and freely drink, asses and hyenas." So this is a very cryptic, a very symbolic picture uttered by a prophet of, you know, destruction that's being wrought or coming onto the people from the gods. Now, this really interestingly, this is the Dear Allah inscription. I don't know if you've heard of this before.
Sure.
So this is a text that was written with paint on the walls of a plaster in the room of a building. What's really, really interesting about this inscription is that it tells us that these are the visions of Balaam, the son of Beor, who we know from the biblical text. We know of Balaam from the book of Numbers, right? Numbers chapter 22 to 24. And what's really interesting about Balaam in the Bible is he's depicted as this prophet who was a traitor to Israel. you know, he advised the king of Moab. And in many of his prophecies, he has these, you know, predictions of the future and, you know, what's going to happen. I think one of the very, what became a strong, a very popular text among apocalyptic Jews actually came out of Balaam's prophecies. A star, okay, right, shall arise out of Jacob. A star from the line of Judah, a scepter out of Jacob. You know, an eternal king is going to rise out of you. So, but here you have, like, at Deir Allah, you actually have almost a Moabite version of this same figure.
Cool.
Where he's presented really positively, but kind of in the same respect, right? Like he's in conversation with the gods and he's learning about the future and he's preaching to the people about how they can protect themselves and the things that they need to do in order to avoid destruction. So this is kind of where this prophetic office begins, these sort of ideas about how prophets communicate with the gods. Now there's other elements of this too, right? Like those are the early roots of this.
Yeah.
The Judean kingdom came to an end in 586 BCE. The Babylonians came in and they sacked Jerusalem. They burned the royal quarter to the ground, and then they exiled all of, you know, the leading citizens, right? The king and his household and all the powerful people. This was the policy of the Babylonians, right? You keep your enemies close. So anybody who could potentially mount a rebellion in a place that's far away from the city of Babylon, you just take them with you. It's much harder to mount a rebellion, you know, when you're directly under the eyes of the people who conquered you than it is, you know, back home. So within Babylon, we also have elements of these sorts of ideas with regards to who the gods were and how to communicate with them and what they would what they would say to you. And we have a number of texts that come out of Assyria and out of Babylon in particular. Scholars have often identified these as mantic wisdom text. So these are literally thousands of omen and divination texts that were mostly inscribed on pieces of pottery, on some clay tablets. And we also have some really interesting texts from Babylon, which have this projection of this sort of cosmic dualistic worldview in places like the Uruk prophecy from the 6th century or the dynastic prophecy from the 3rd century. The really interesting thing about the dynastic prophecy that we also see in a lot of apocalyptic Jewish literature is this idea that these great people from the distant past actually forecasted and foretold the future. They got a vision sort of into the secret knowledge that the gods possess with regards to the construction of the cosmos, and were able to, you know, communicate that to common people. So you've heard of, some people in your audience will have heard of this figure from Babylon, Nabonidus. He was the last king of Babylon. He was a very, very unpopular ruler in the city of Babylon. He was not part of the dynastic line of Nebuchadnezzar II. Who was the son of Nabopolassar. These were the founders of the Neo-Babylonian Empire, really oversaw Babylon at its zenith, at its height. And, you know, after the death of Nebuchadnezzar, there was a handful of weaker rulers, which is often the case, and you know, they kept on getting killed off, and finally this outsider, Nabal Palasser, came in and took control and managed to establish his power in the city of Babylon. But he like I said, he was an outsider, and he did some very unusual things. He decided to basically forsake the old gods, the temple of Marduk, the god of Babylon, Marduk. He decided, no, we're no longer going to set our focus on Marduk. He was the worshiper of another deity called Set. And so he focused all of his attention on the cult of Set to the expense of the cult of Marduk, which upset people very, very much, as you can imagine. And then he left the city. He probably had some sort of illness of some sort, but he left the city and then just retreated to this site out in this sort of oasis out in the wilderness called Tiama, and he lived out his days there. Now, during this time, the people in Babylon were very frustrated with this character and with how things were going. And this is really sort of the theme of the dynastic prophecy, which purports to have been written way back in the, even before the time of Nabonidus and Nebuchadnezzar. It purports to have been written way back in like the 7th or the 8th century BCE, and it pretends to predict what's going to happen in Babylon with the rise of Nabopolassar and with the rise of Nebuchadnezzar and all the wonderful things that are, you know, going to happen. And then it ends on this real sour note. You know, in column 2, we read in the dynastic prophecy about Nabonidus. And it says this about him. It says, a rebel prince will arise, the dynasty of Haran. He will establish for 17 years. He will exercise sovereignty. He will oppress the land of the festival of Esagil. He will cancel a fortress in Babylon. He will build. He will plot evil against Akkad. This is one of these features, right, of this apocalyptic worldview, is that the men who are connected to the gods, the men who have insight into the divine secrets, will project these into, you know, they'll get this information from the gods and they'll write them down, and you can have access to this deep knowledge about the future. Sure. So, right? So this is what we call exeventu prophecies, right? And this wasn't invented by the Jews. They certainly picked up on this. This is part of the wider milieu, and they probably picked this up from texts and from traditions that they saw in places like Babylon.
So, and this sounds very familiar, because, you know, the idea that we've got a text, it claims to have been written a long time ago, but it's actually talking about contemporary politics. We find that in the Jewish script, we find that in Daniel, yeah. We find that all over the place. So
see it in the Book of Jubilees.
This has got a regional sort of context. Yeah. Okay.
Absolutely. So, yeah, it's very cool. Now, one of the other, I have to say something else about this too, and this is something that a lot of people miss with regards to the emergence and the development of apocalypticism. So we have prophecy on the one side. We've got this Babylonian sort of mantic magical ideology on another side, and along with that are also these wisdom traditions.
Yeah.
Now, and this is something, you know, we think of wisdom literature in. Most of us know it from the Bible, from texts like the book of Proverbs or the book of Job or, you know, the book of Ecclesiastes. The book of Job and the book of Ecclesiastes especially are what scholars will classify as theodicies. These are texts that are grappling with this question of the problem of evil, really.
Yep.
Why do bad things happen to good people?
Yeah,
and apocalyptic. Sorry.
Particularly Job, but
absolutely, well. Right? Yeah, Job is all about that. But you know, it makes sense too that apocalypticism would sort of filter out of this sort of a worldview, because in many respects, apocalypticism I often like to think of, I like to describe as sort of the ultimate theodicy. It's a theodicy on steroids.
That's very good point, because ultimately it is answering the question, well, why is this shit happening to us?
Yeah.
Why is all this bad stuff happening? Because, you know, you were talking before about the powers of good and powers of evil, and the powers of evil increasing and becoming dominant. And if you're in a world like the world, for example, of certain Galilean peasants in the say the early first century, where Herod Antipas is oppressing your family, the Romans are basically the protection racket above him, and they're the latest in a succession of bad guys that have been oppressing you, then you're going to ask why. So I've never really thought about that, but you're right. This is theodicy. This is
absolutely
evil. That's a really good point.
One of the interesting things that we see now, I mean, we have our understanding of apocalypticism in the Second Temple period was dramatically improved and enhanced with the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, you know, starting in 1947, roughly 1,000 Jewish manuscripts. That's manuscripts. In terms of actual material, you're talking about tens of thousands of fragments. And most of it, we have copies of so-called biblical texts, copies of texts from the Bible, which is really my specialization. But most of the literature is all these other Jewish texts. Many of them we already knew, things like the Book of Jubilees, or the books of Enoch copies are, you know, exist in the Dead Sea Scrolls written in Hebrew and Aramaic, which is really exciting. The presence of these Aramaic texts. Interestingly enough, one of the things that we see in the Dead Sea Scrolls is a lot of the Aramaic texts themselves are sort of the strongest, the most fiercely apocalyptic, but then also have the earmarks of, you know, sort of this priestly wisdom, kind of a milieu out of which they come, right? You know, but this is one of the things that we see within the Dead Sea Scrolls, which is really interesting, is tons of apocalyptic literature written in both Aramaic and Hebrew. But then we also have a ton of so-called wisdom texts. There is one of the most important compositions at Qumran is a text that's called Instruction. We have numerous copies of it. Like I think there's 6 or 7 copies of this text called Instruction, and it's enormous. Like it's a huge work. We don't have the whole thing. We have bits and pieces of it that are extant in, you know, fragments from a number of copies. But this is what it is, right? It's just a collection of wisdom, very similar to what you see in the Book of Proverbs or the Book of Ben Sira, which was written in around 180 BCE. Very similar to Ben Sira. Very similar to other texts like the Wisdom of Solomon, right? So you've got like this combination of these types of texts and these types of ideas, and really it sort of makes sense when you think about it, because the best I think the simplest way to understand what wisdom literature is from the Bible, and then also, you know, within the early Jewish texts. So these are like the products of navel gazing from sages, right? People, wealthy individuals, you know, very well educated for the time, people who are you know, in the aristocracy and in the sort of the elite members of society who can afford the time and the wherewithal to learn, you know, to read and to write and to contemplate the secrets of the universe. And so this is sort of where apocalypticism begins, out of this idea that you can investigate nature to find the secrets of the universe. It's grounded in this idea that there is a God out there who's in control of everything. Now, in the earlier wisdom texts, some of the earlier wisdom traditions we have operate on this ethic of reciprocity, right? The righteous prosper and the wicked suffer.
Yeah.
Theodicies begin because over time it becomes clear to everyone that this just doesn't work.
It's not true.
It's not true. And now, how do you deal with that within this worldview? So then you've got the development of theodicy that you see in the book of Job. And I've mentioned the book of Ecclesiastes, which is a little different, but is really addressing the same sort of concerns, but arriving at different conclusions, right? Like, you know, ultimately it doesn't matter. There's, you know, good, evil, whatever. It's just, you know, just do your best and hopefully things will work out for you. Really, I mean, that's kind of the message of Ecclesiastes, but it's born out of this real sense of discomfort with the fact that, you know, good and evil happen to everyone. How do we explain this? And, you know, this is apocalypticism is really born out of this, these emerging ideas and then amped up to like 11. As a result of, you know, the destruction of the city of Jerusalem and the Babylonian exile, because for most of Judean history, the throne, the house of David, was sort of the guarantor of the presence of Yahweh and the success of the kingdom, right? So when the Babylonians came in and basically just wiped all of that out, this produced an existential crisis for these people. You know, it makes sense that this sort of an ideology emerged out of this experience, coupled with a growing familiarity with the traditions in Babylon. And over time, it kind of filters its way down to the common people. I think one of the things that we see is that apocalypticism is most often gains traction in times of oppression or marginalization. When times are bad, it's good for apocalypticism. That's, you know,
that actually makes a great deal of sense. In fact, we see that in our own time as well.
Yeah, totally,
we see this, you know, this eschatological stuff gets more traction in periods where people are anxious. But a really interesting point. So what you're saying is effectively this began as an elite contemplation of the problem of evil.
Yeah.
In the context of the collapse of, you know, the destruction of the original Jewish Judaic kingdoms, and then developed in that context and filtered down until you get to the point where you've got peasant preachers such as a bloke called Jesus or another one called John preaching it to the masses in periods where, as you say, things are particularly bad. such as in the early first century. So it makes sense that it's bubbling up. Same with the Qumran stuff, because it comes from a period of crisis in the previous century.
And that's, you know, that's one of the things that we see. Like I would say now, the other thing from an historical perspective, the other thing that has an important impact here is what happened basically in between the second and the first century with the Hasmonean kingdom, right?
Sure. Yep.
In a period of crisis, sort of towards the beginning, in the middle of the second century, you have the desecration of the Jerusalem temple, the emergence of Hellenism, the cultural the cultural assimilation that accompanied the spread of Greek thought and literature, and a strong resistance to that. Yeah. From members, you know, from sort of the purists in Jerusalem and the Judeans, which sparked this revolt, right? Antiochus the IV sacrifices a pig in the temple. You know, just about the most provocative thing you could do. These purists go crazy and they start this rebellion, ultimately getting the Seleucids out. And for the first time in hundreds of years, the establishment of a quasi independent Judean kingdom, which ended up becoming, for like this nearly 100 year period, the Hasmonean kingdom may have been the most powerful Jewish kingdom in history up to the modern day, right?
Yeah.
And along with this, people, you know, over time, as what happens with all political movements, you know, this marriage between the church and the state eventually leads to these unacceptable levels of corruption. Where the people who wrote and collected the Dead Sea Scrolls come in, you know, this is a group of mostly like in, they emerge from a priestly group of some sort, which has become just disgusted and extremely dissatisfied with how much the priesthood in the Temple of Jerusalem has become politicized. And they set this strong focus on the need for purity in the temple, in their own community. One of the things I point to, I'll mention again, this article that I wrote about comparing and contrasting, you know, a modern apocalyptic worldview, like you see in AMC's great, it was great for a few seasons, this great TV show, The Walking Dead, and what you see in the Dead Sea Scrolls. One of the things that a lot of people don't pick up on is this strong sense of ritual purity. This was a real sticking point for the writers and the collectors of the Dead Sea Scrolls. And I think it came out of this idea that the temple had just been so irreparably corrupted by these people who were not worthy of the office, who did not observe the strict rules of Yahweh, and they as a result they became obsessed with purity. It absolutely permeates all of their literature, to the point they were so upset and they were so determined about the need for ritual purity as well as the corruption of the Jerusalem temple, that they eventually came to the position that there was no, you know, the Hasmoneans, when they defeated the Seleucids, were able to come in and purify the temple precincts in order to make it useful again. For the writers and the collectors of the Dead Sea Scrolls, I mean, there's no, for the most part, their expectation is that you can't even do that.
Okay.
The temple just needs to be destroyed.
Yeah.
And in the last days, the celestial temple of Yahweh, of God, is going to come down onto earth for the rest of time. In fact, the writers and the collectors of the Dead Sea Scrolls were convinced that they would, on a regular basis, go up and worship in the celestial temple in the presence of the angels. This is an ongoing theme.
It's interesting because there's a parallel there with the Jesus stuff.
That's true.
Because,
because
Mark 13 is all about the destruction of the temple, and obviously Mark 13 is written in the wake of what happened in AD 70, where the temple wasn't destroyed, was profaned and then destroyed by the Romans. But I would argue that Jesus, the historical Jesus, probably did say something along the lines of, "It's this temple is going to be destroyed." There's elements in the temple
kill the Romans,
and there's elements in the trial accounts that seem to echo that, where Jesus is accused of saying, "You're going to destroy the temple," and the gospel writers kind of skip around that, and even the stoning of Stephen seems to be something about him speaking against the temple. So there's this theme, and it connects to Qumran, and it also connects all the way back to the destruction of the first temple.
Absolutely.
So there's this thread all the way through where you can really see that this is an obsession. But I think probably the other one that I wanted to ask you about is, you mentioned that about the Hasmonean kingdom, and before that the Judean kingdoms. The Messiah is this other theme that comes through, which is about a king, and it goes under so many mutations. We've got the Son of Man figure in the Gospels. You know, Jesus seems to be claiming that he is that figure. Tell us about the Messiah and the evolution of that. I mean, we could do a whole show on this.
But yeah, right. Summarize that. So now, because again, like it's one of the things that I'll go back. I think we have to go back, really to the destruction by the Babylonians of the first temple to sort of get our grounding in the development of the theology of the Messiah, of Messianism. And people need to bear in mind, I mentioned towards the beginning that the people who were exiled, right, these were these were the court officials, this was the aristocracy, this was the literati, these were the readers and writers, and they kind of set themselves up as this righteous remnant who's going to come back, and through which the true nation of Israel is going to be restored. What a lot of people miss in this conversation, in the history here, is that the land was not emptied. Like, there was still people there when the exile happened. They just happened to be all the poor people, right? So when you have this group of returnees, 50, 60 years later, coming back into Judea, these are, again, the literati, the aristocracy, those who were controlling the literature and the priesthood, from the old days. They're the ones who are coming back and kind of setting themselves in opposition to the people who were left there. Very often you see this expression in the book of Jeremiah, in the book of Second Kings. It talks about the Am Ha'aretz. These are the people of the land, and they're often depicted as the bad guys, when in actual fact they're just the poor people, right? but this is sort of where this ideology of messianism kind of starts. Is there's this emerging idea that while the kingdom of David came to an end with the destruction of the temple and the death of Zechariah, who was the last in the line of David, there was this growing expectation among these temple elites, and probably people still connected to the royal family, right? Who started to develop this expectation for a new king, a new son of David, who's going to come back one day. You know, it just never happened for a variety of reasons, but it also didn't in any, the fact that it never happened didn't in any way diminish the hope. What it actually did was it started to turn it into this stronger cosmic ideal. Now, importantly, the Messiah, who was thought to be this anointed cosmic king of the last days, who was going to eventually come in and restore the throne of David. From the very start, this was always going to be a human being. Okay. He had to have been, right? Yeah. The king, you know, the last king of David, the ruler in the last days on earth of this new restored kingdom was a descendant of David. By the facts of reality, he had to be a human being in the lineage of David. So the word itself, Mashiach, from which we get Messiah, it just means the anointed one. And it's not used very often in the Hebrew Bible. Where it is used in some of the earliest texts is with reference just to kings and to prophets. The kings of Judah in particular, when they were described in the Bible, they were always described as sons of David, but they were also often described as sons of God. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's this sort of this melding of ideas about this earthly king who's going to come in and restore the fortunes of Israel with, I guess, a more spiritualization of this idea of, you know, the Son of God not just being the king on earth, but a cosmic figure. Yeah. In the last days. And you start to see some of this come out in texts like the book of First Enoch or in the book of Daniel, which is really, you know, the book of Daniel is really developing ideas which come out in some of the earliest stages of the book of Enoch in the book of the Watchers or in the animal apocalypse. So that's sort of where some of these ideas start, but they sort of gain a fullness in the book of Daniel. The other thing the book of Daniel does is it's starting, I think, to more closely identify the high priest with the king. So you actually, like, one of the few places where you see this term mentioned, Mashiach, Messiah, is with reference to the priest, Onias the Third, who is murdered,
yeah,
in the temple.
So,
right?
So the Messiah's kind of taking on a bit of a priestly,
yeah,
element. Yeah, that makes sense.
Absolutely. Yeah. And in the Qumran community, you know, there wasn't just one Messiah. It wasn't just the son of David, right? The Dead Sea Scrolls, there's lots of talk about in the last days there being a Messiah, a Mashiach ben David, Messiah, son of David, and a Mashiach ben Aharon, the Messiah, the son of Aaron. So there's an eschatological priest, Messiah, and a king, Messiah. And then
we get parallels in the Jesus stuff.
Yes.
He's presented both as a kingly Messiah, but also in a way as a kind of a priestly Messiah as well. There's that.
Yeah, element. It's a, you know, it's almost, he's like the book of Hebrews especially.
Yeah.
Talks about Jesus as the high priest, right? But he's also the atoning sacrifice. So it's a very strange kind of strange kind of amalgamation. And this is honestly, this is where I think you get a lot of confusion as well when it comes to the Dead Sea Scrolls and their depiction of the Messiah. There's a lot of conflation taking place in modern treatments of this, in particular from people who don't know what they're doing when they approach the text, because you have these varieties of descriptions of different figures, right? On the one hand, you've got texts that describe the eschatological rule of the Mashiach ben David, the Messiah, son of David, and you've got texts describing the administration of the Mashiach ben Acharon, this eschatological priest. People will often just mix this stuff up and conflate these ideas. The other thing that they will do is they'll look at, we have numerous texts which speak of, you know, a high priest in the last days making atonement for the sins of all the people. And very often this is misread as, you know, a self-sacrifice, as the death of the priest or the death of the Messiah. When in actual fact, most of the time, what this is the priest performing his priestly duties in the last day's temple. He's offering sacrifices. It's the sacrifices that continue to make atonement. The priest is the one who's performing the action, but not in his own death.
He's not the victim. Yeah.
He's not
and we've discussed there are certain people who shall remain nameless who seem to think that there's a strong tradition of the idea of a Messiah who was going to die before Christianity. And so that did not arise out of a historical Jesus actually being crucified. It actually gave rise to a mythic Jesus who dies in the heavens.
Yeah.
So this is our good friend Richard Carrier.
Now, I was going to call him Lord Voldemort, but
yeah. So I mentioned the name, but without going into the whole mythicist thing, which is so bloody tedious, I am interested. I mean, obviously, you don't think that. You don't think that there's a good or strong tradition or even a tradition of a dying Messiah, no?
Certainly not a strong tradition.
Okay.
And this is part of the problem, too, when it comes to the scrolls, because so much of our material is so highly fragmentary, there's lots of ways that you can approach different texts and, you know, read them or even misread them.
Yeah.
So, you know, one of the things, and this is, you know, one of the really exciting things for many biblical scholars, in particular, many New Testament scholars when the scrolls were discovered, was just to see this sharp overlap between much of the apocalyptic ideology present in the Dead Sea Scrolls with what's happening in the New Testament, right?
Yep.
You know, so much of this start really was helpful for grounding ideas that had already been around for quite a while. Albert Schweitzer, you know, was sort of the father of this idea that Jesus properly belonged within this apocalyptic Jewish movement. And, you know, when the Dead Sea Scrolls were discovered, it just became so much more obvious and, you know, so much more well-grounded. Now, what happens is lots of scholars, I think in particular, in the early 1990s, when the scrolls were starting to, I can't get into the very complicated, frustrating history of publication of the Dead Sea Scrolls. But, you know, it's kind of a mess. If you're interested in any of that, I actually have a series on my channel called The Dead Sea Scrolls Apologetically, where I talk a lot about the history of the discovery too, which is fascinating. But anyways, long story short, most of the Dead Sea Scrolls didn't start to actually become public knowledge that nothing was published until the 1990s. Huge amounts of the material started to come out. And I think what happened was a lot of these New Testament scholars, as well as really well-meaning, mostly evangelical Christian scholars, started to look at this stuff and go, wow, you know, there's these fragmentary texts which sure look like they're describing, you know, the death of a Messiah. Yeah. And it's understandable why they would come to some of these conclusions too, right? Like one of the more famous examples of this is 11Q13, the so-called Melchizedek scroll, which is a really interesting manuscript, which seems to depict this cosmic figure, this angelic figure of the last days, in conjunction with all these prophecies just kind of pulled out. You know, there's prophecies from the book of Psalms mixed with prophecies from the book of Isaiah, and then Daniel chapter 9, which is the prophecy of, you know, the death of Onias III. And importantly, very frustratingly, all we have is mention of the beginning part. You know, this is what was said in the book of Daniel concerning the Messiah, and then the text breaks off, and then it continues on the next line. So, you know, lots of scholars right away got really excited and said, well, this is the prophecy about where the Messiah was cut off and killed.
Yep.
But, you know, it's not that simple, because when you work through the whole text, which is really just about establishing a proper chronology for the end times, this is a temporal marker, and the available space for the reconstruction actually seems to align better with the preceding verse, which talks about the rise of the Prince Messiah, right? Yep. So there's things like this. I know James Tabor very much likes to point to another one of these manuscripts, 4Q285, which is it, and it's just literally just a single fragment which describes, you know, this battle between the people, the sons of light in the last days, who are fighting on behalf of God against the forces of darkness, the armies of this group called the Kittim, which seem most commonly to be identified with the Romans themselves. Yep. And then in this fragment, you know, it says they're going to rout the Kittim, and then it says on the next line. And this is just a sort of a bugaboo about the way that Hebrew grammar works, especially when it lacks the vowel pointing as it did in antiquity. You know, a word look can mean totally opposite things, even though it looks exactly the same. So, you know, James Tabor liked to translate and interpret this line, which he thought said, they will kill or put to death the prince of the congregation, which is another term that's very commonly used to identify this Messiah Ben David, right? The Messiah, the son of Israel. So, I mean, that's one way you could translate this word. It does seem odd, though, that in the very next line, the people are rejoicing and celebrating, you know. So, and a number of scholars have pointed this out. One of my mentors, Martin Abegg, wrote an excellent article on this, where he pointed out, well, you know, this probably doesn't work because of that. Yeah. And also within Hebrew, and if you pay close attention to the grammar there, a more appropriate translation of this would be, the prince of the congregation will kill him. Probably with reference to the king of the Khatim, who's mentioned, you know, just a couple of lines earlier,
which
they've just routed.
Which would explain
why people are happy about it, right? You know, so there's many of these. This is one of the frustrating things, right? Is we have this highly fragmentary evidence, and there is a tantalizing overlap with a lot of the ideas promoted within Christianity. And to be perfectly honest, this is still an open question.
Sure.
We just don't have enough information from the scrolls, from all of the early Jewish literature, to say with much confidence that there was this strong belief in a suffering, dying Messiah. Maybe, but it seems most likely that this is not something that happens until quite a bit later.
Sure.
We start to see this sort of thing, or certainly with the rise of Christianity, is where I see you think that I think you see them picking up on this idea. And yeah, there's probably some it probably just doesn't come out of nowhere, right? This is probably something that's percolating among some of Jewish communities, but you really don't see this start to take shape until after the destruction of the second temple, and in particular the death of Simon Bar Kokhba after the second Jewish revolt, right?
So for the Christian stuff, I'd say, I mean, you'd have to argue that the primary impetus for that understanding of the theology was Jesus being crucified.
Yeah.
You know, so the crisis caused by that, and then, okay, how do we interpret this within the context? So it's, as you say, it doesn't come from nowhere, but is there enough there to say, well, that's what caused that idea? You and I agree that that's not the case.
It's like it's a step too far, and that's one of the things too, right? Like a responsible appraisal of this evidence, and if you read the scholarship carefully and responsibly, most of the scholars, I mean my own Dr. Fodder, George J. Broke, wrote an article about the possibility of there being a an underlying understanding that the Messiah was going to die. He's reading this out of another text, 4Q 541, which is an Aramaic text. Again, very highly fragmentary. Again, the interpretation of which is not uncontroversial. I mean, there's lots of scholarly weigh in on what this text is and what it means. He forwarded this idea. Well, maybe this is something that aligns with this idea of the a priestly figure who's going to die. But he's really cautious in terms of how he's talking about this, right? He's not remotely dogmatic about it. He's raising it as a possibility, but while also acknowledging the enormous setbacks or drawbacks in this idea. Like it could be any variety of, well, not any variety of things, but it doesn't necessarily have to be that. It's one of these things that you can throw out there, but it's just not strongly or well attested or well established.
Sure. I did have two other questions I wanted to ask.
Sure.
We could talk all day.
We probably could.
But I suppose one was, when we're thinking about the Messiah, you were talking about how it's actually kind of a cluster of ideas.
Mm.
What about the idea that the Messiah had a heavenly pre-existence? Because there does seem to be some indications in the Pauline material, particularly Philippians, that he thinks that Jesus is someone who came from heaven and manifested himself on earth as a human being.
Right.
Is that found in the Qumran material or in any of the intertestamental apocalyptic material?
Yeah. So I think some of this comes out of texts like First Enoch. Which is as I mentioned, sort of the grounding for a lot of them, what you read in the Book of Daniel, you know, the mention of the Son of Man who is sitting at the right hand of the Ancient of Days and coming on the clouds. One of the things that you see in the Qumran literature, one of the non-biblical texts with which I have some familiarity, there's a couple of these texts, the War Scroll and some of the texts related to that. And one of the things that you see in there is this focus on the important role that's going to be played in the last days by the Archangel Michael.
Okay.
The War Scroll explicitly says that Michael's going to come in and help to win the battle, the last battle. The way the War Scroll is structured, it's this interesting text. It's not really an apocalypse in the way that we think of it in terms of an historical reconstruction leading up to the last days. It's more actually of a sort of a liturgical rule text describing what's going to happen in the end. It's a very unusual sort of a document. But within this text, you've got the way it works out, it starts with this endless number of rules and procedures for how the army is to conduct itself in the last days. Tons of rules with regards to purity.
Yep.
Of course, this is really important because, according to the text, the Sons of Light, these are the human members of presumably the Qumran community, you know, living out in the wilderness, the Sons of Light are going to be enlisted in battle alongside the army of God and the angels. So they're literally in the camp with the angels. Yep. And because of that, it's super important that the camp retains a sense of ritual purity, right? It's it's pretty interesting when you think of it in these terms. So there's these endless number of rules about how to keep things pure and what the priest needs to do in the procedures of getting everybody ready for battle. And then it talks about the final war of the last days taking place over the course of 7 battles. And they take turns. The forces of evil, known as the Sons of Belial, the forces of darkness, are going to win the first 3 battles. The Sons of Light and the Sons of Darkness, they're going to sort of go back and forth, each winning a battle. The Sons of Darkness are going to win 3, and the Sons of Light are going to win 3. And then finally, in this last encounter, in the 7th battle, God and the Archangel Michael are going to break through in the moment when things seem to be the darkest, when the Sons of Light are at pushed to the brink and at the point of destruction. You know, Michael's going to come in and save the day. So there's this angelic figure. Right. There's one of my ideas, something that I've written about is it's really interesting when you look at some of the sources for the War Scroll. We have this text, which was written sometime in the first century CE. But we also have other texts at Qumran, which look like they may have served as source material. So, you know, you can do some really interesting text and source criticism in the Dead Sea Scrolls. And there's one document which seems to have sort of laid the groundwork for this idea of the angel, the Archangel Michael, coming in and rescuing everyone. And this is I'll just read a little bit of it to you. It's commonly called the self-glorification hymn. And it appears in a couple of places in the Dead Sea Scrolls. In one text, identified as 4Q491, which also has fragments which are part of the war scroll. It takes place in, you know, it appears in another collection of hymns, which is really interesting. Hymns that were attributed to the leader of the community, the teacher of righteousness is thought to have written this literature. So, but this is 4Q491 is what I'm looking for here. So this is the so-called self glorification hymn. Blessed be the God of Israel, the one who keeps mercy for his covenant and pledges of deliverance for his people. He called those who are tottering to wondrous exploits and has gathered the assembly of nations for destruction with no remnant in order to raise up injustice for the melting heart and to open the mouth of the dumb with God's marvels, to train feeble hands for warfare. Those with knocking knees he gives strength to stand upright and vigor of loins. To broken backs among the poor in spirit is the authority over a hard heart. By the perfect ones of the path, all the wicked nations shall be destroyed. Their heroes will not remain standing. But we are the remnant of your people. Blessed be your name, God of mercies, who has wondrously bestowed your mercies on to us during the empire of Belial. With all the mysteries of his enmity, they have not separated us from your covenant. You have chased away from us his spirits of destruction. When the men of the empire acted wickedly, you protected the soul of your redeemed ones. And now you have raised the fallen with your strength. But those in high stature you cut down to humiliate them, for none of their heroes there is a savior. For their swift ones there is no escape. To their notables you shall scorn all their useless existence. You will turn to nothing. That wasn't it. No, that was. Hold on. Am I in the right place? No, that's the wrong place. Rats. Never mind that.
We can edit
that out. It's on a different page. It's the way this book. Here we go. Sorry. I thought it sounded strange. Okay. Anyways, here's the self-glorification hymn, and it's very fragmentary, but this is the best we can make of it here. It opens by saying, someone has done awesome things marvelously in the strength of his power. The just exult, and the holy ones, these are divine beings, rejoice in justice. He has established Israel from eternity, his truth and the mysteries of his wisdom in all generations, might in the council of the poor for an eternal congregation, the perfect ones of something eternal, a mighty throne in the congregation of the gods, above which none of the kings of the east shall sit, and their nobles not. And then it breaks off. And then it says, this is speaking in the first person, which is really interesting. It says, my glory is incomparable, and besides me, no one is exalted nor comes to me, for I reside in the heavens, and there is no one. I am counted among the gods, and my dwelling is in the holy congregation. My desire is in accordance to the flesh, but all that is precious to me is in the glory of something, the holy dwelling. Who has been considered despicable on my account, and who is comparable to me in glory? Who, like the sailors, will come back and tell? Who bears all the sorrow like me, and who suffers evil like me? There is no one. I have been instructed, and there is no teaching comparable to my teaching. And it goes on and on like this, right? But it's very interesting, him expressing this figure's incomparable position in the heavens, right? Among the gods.
Yeah.
There's no one like me. All the other divine beings are nothing compared to me. Then also talks about, you know, suffering and coming alongside the people and struggling with them. What's really interesting about this particular manuscript is this hymn appears in one column, and then in the very next column is the description of this final battle, in which, you know, the sons of light are eventually going to be triumphant. Okay. With the aid of this supernatural figure, right? He's not called Michael. in this early version. But in the later text in the War Scroll, suddenly, you know, he's identified as this angelic figure. Sorry, this was a really long way to come about answering the question about this pre-existent Messiah. You know, it's texts like this. It's this developing angelology that takes place in the Second Temple period. You know, this much more systematic understanding of the forces, the heavenly forces of God. You pick a lot of this up from texts like First Enoch, which gives a whole bunch of the angels names.
Yeah.
And then, you know, describes their functions within God's government or whatever his cosmic administration up there. And you know, a lot of this comes out of there's a lot more to say about this too. We have, you know, one of the things, the Book of Daniel, the Book of Enoch as well, a little bit, but more so in the Book of Daniel, one of the things they do is sort of draw imagery from the Canaanite literature, from texts like the Baal cycle, in speaking of the last days. And really what Daniel does is he kind of turns this divine council. Yeah. You know, there's this great God overseeing all the other gods who are competing and fighting amongst each other for the increase of their own territories. That's in the Baal cycle, right? The Book of Daniel is taking that and sort of turning it a bit, where this council of deities has now become, you know, these angelic beings. The Son of Man, the one who sits on the right hand of the Ancient of Days, which is a term that's actually comes straight out of the Baal cycle.
Oh, really?
You know, and the description of him too is as this figure with white hair, right, sitting on a throne. This is all Baal cycle, which is really interesting.
Sure. But just back to the angelology stuff. I mean, I mentioned Philippians, and it's a text that Christians often try to use to argue that Paul is saying that Jesus was God. Whereas actually, if you look what it says he did not consider equality with God something to be seized, but rather humbled himself and took the form of a slave. But it seems to be, given what you were just saying then, he seems to be conceiving of Jesus before coming to earth as a kind of an angel who was very high but was not as exalted as he was after he became a human, died, and then was raised and was then exalted above all others. That seems to be the progression, and it actually fits pretty well with that Qumran material you were just talking about.
Right, right. It's you know, the self-glorification hymn.
Yeah,
really, right? It's this divine being, and I think that's a really important. It's really important to note that, you know, you particularly within the Second Temple period, we're at a point where divine beings. We have to remember this all kind of came out of this Canaanite polytheistic world, and worldview. But by the time of the third century, which is when most scholars point to the writing of the earliest layers of the books of Enoch, by the third century, by the second century in particular, you have this sense that divine beings are not even gods anymore. They're like these, they're somewhere between humans and the great God, right? Yeah. Like they've sort of taken the place of this divine council. And I think the reason for that also probably has something to do with the exile, with the destruction of Jerusalem and the exile, because they came out of this world where, you know, the kingdom of Judah and Yahweh was one, you know, tribal national deity among many, and he controlled his kingdom, which was Judah, and had his house, which was in the temple in Jerusalem, and he would have confrontations with other Canaanite deities. We read of one of these, you know, in 2 Kings chapter 3, Yahweh has an encounter with the god Chemosh, who's the god of Moab, and actually loses, right? So this is very embarrassing, but at least the city, you know, Jerusalem remained intact. And or sorry, I should say this was the kingdom of Israel in the north. So at least, you know, right. The city of Samaria remained intact. His house didn't get destroyed, so he was okay. He lived to fight another day, is the way you would say it, right? Sure. But this is sort of the world, is these kings and their gods are all in competition with each other and never really getting anywhere, you know, expansive. They're all just part of this little world.
Yeah.
But then when the Assyrians first come in and they wipe out the northern kingdom entirely in 722 BCE, then in a couple hundred years later, 150 years later, thereabouts, the Babylonians come in and completely wipe out the Judean kingdom. You know, this in effect has to, this old worldview can no longer survive under these conditions. The ideology of these people has very much been internationalized on this grand scale, where all of a sudden the world is much bigger than just this little group of tribes who are constantly, you know, involved in these local skirmishes to this grand imperial world. And as a result of that, right, their God, Yahweh, had to assume this position as the king of all the gods and like the king of the universe, really.
Yeah, because suddenly the perspective is bigger, so we have to paint him on a bigger canvas.
He's got
to
be a much bigger god and more powerful, and he can see the end from the beginning and all this stuff, right?
Just one last question then, because you just mentioned seeing the end. And you're aware that I recently appeared on the Paul Logica show and was talking.
Oh, yeah.
Addressing some Christian apologists.
You looked great on that show, by the way.
I looked remarkably like Bart Ehrman.
Somebody said Bart Ehrman with tips, I think, right?
With frosted tips, yeah.
With frosted tips.
I've copped a lot of flack from some of my friends regarding that avatar. For those who aren't familiar with what we're talking about, I'd say check out Paul Logica's channel, where I appeared as a guest and talked about, I think, a really key apocalyptic point, the imminence. Mm. So the fact that this stuff is going to happen in the future, but in the New Testament, I would argue, Christians obviously don't, Jesus is clearly depicted as saying it's going to happen soon. It's going to happen within the lifetime of the people that are listening to me right now, which is obviously a problem for modern Christians because that was 2,000 years ago. But I'm interested in whether we see a similar urgency in, say, the Qumran material. Do we see this idea that it's not just happening soon, it's going to happen real soon? Do we get that?
Yeah, absolutely. So, okay. You know, like one of the things that we see in the Dead Sea Scrolls is this idea that the last days are upon us.
Uh-huh.
You know, history has unfolded as established by God up to this point, and we're just now on the knife's edge.
Uh-huh.
The community is living out, it has to go out into the wilderness. Interestingly enough, one of the founding documents of the Dead Sea Scrolls is a text called the Sirach HaYachad, which translates into something like the rule of the community.
Yep.
At one point in this text, it talks about the rationale for going out into the wilderness and setting up this community is to prepare the way for the coming of the day of Yahweh, the day of the Lord. very interestingly, it employs Isaiah 40 verse 3 they are the fulfillment of this prophecy from Isaiah, which most people are familiar with from the New Testament, because in the Gospels, this text is cited by the Gospel writers as being fulfilled in the life of John the Baptist.
Yeah.
And they misread the text, the Gospel writers do, when they cite it, because they say, the passage says, there's a voice crying in the wilderness, go and prepare the way of Yahweh, make straight his paths. The way the Gospels translate or interpret this passage is, there is a voice crying in the wilderness, comma, go and prepare the ways of Yahweh, make straight his paths. And they're applying that to John the Baptist as the voice crying in the wilderness. Well, the proper way of reading this passage and the way the Qumran community read it was that they were to go out and be in the wilderness, because that's what the voice said. Go into the wilderness and prepare the way of Yahweh, because it's coming soon. And throughout piles of their texts, there is this same urgency, right? You have to keep yourself absolutely ritually pure. You have to observe the rules and the stipulations of the Torah. There has to be someone. This is something else that the community rule says, is that there is to be someone at all times reading aloud the laws, basically the scriptures and their interpretation, 24 hours a day. There's somebody who's just constantly, you know, reading through, because you're getting ready for the end.
Yeah.
And the writers and the collectors of the Dead Sea Scrolls they're sort of like, it's interesting because both Josephus and Philo describe the Essenes, with whom this literature is identified, as pacifists. And you look at a lot of their literature, which talks about, you know, annihilating the Romans and wiping out all of their enemies among the Pharisees. Yeah. You think, well, how does this work? And of course, they're supposed to be, you know, enlisted in the celestial army of God, fighting against the forces of darkness, right? Yeah. They sort of imagine themselves lying in wait in the wilderness and just letting things play out, without their involvement. They very much had this sense that as all apocalyptic movements do, things have just been getting progressively worse and worse and worse. So we're just going to let this play out. And at the very end, God's going to rescue us and destroy all our enemies.
And when the time comes, we're going to be
ready. Which is any day now. We're going to be ready.
Ritually pure. We've got the guy who's reading the scrolls 24 hours a day.
What's that?
I assume they took turns at the reading of the scrolls for 24 hours.
It just says that there's got to be someone doing it. So we assume so. And again, it's interesting too, because it's not just the law; it's the law and the interpretation. It's the text of scripture, and whatever the teacher of righteousness said was the right reading of those texts of scripture.
We probably do need to kind of wrap it up. We've been talking for
after an hour and 45 minutes. Yeah,
exactly.
Or what does it say? An hour and a half.
Kipa, I really would like to thank you for coming on. I mean, there's so many other things we could talk about. You just mentioned John the Baptist.
Oh, I know. Right.
James McGrath's got a book coming out later in the year on John, which I'm really looking forward to reading. But, you know, how he fits into this, of course, there's a whole esoteric New Age idea that Jesus and John were Essenes, which is almost certainly crap. But the connections that I think that you've outlined and detailed are really fascinating. So might have to have you come back, but it'll be great. But look, thank you so much.
Absolutely,
this has been a really good conversation.
It's been fun for me.
Yeah, and it's just great to finally get a chance to talk to you, mate. So
for sure,
thank you. All the best.
Well, thank you for having me.
No problem at all.
Well, I hope you enjoyed my discussion with Dr. Kip Davis. As I mentioned before, he has an excellent YouTube channel, which is well worth a subscription, especially if you're interested in the Dead Sea Scrolls and related topics. I'll put a link in the details of this episode. But until next time, see you again here soon. This has been another History for Atheists podcast. If you've enjoyed this show, please subscribe today. You can also subscribe to the History for Atheists YouTube channel for video versions of this and other shows, or to the original History for Atheists blog for an even more extensive collection of detailed articles on how to avoid errors about religious history. Have a great day.